This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Pauline O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. I have at least two listeners who are totally sold on ivermectin, so let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, I've forwarded one of these letters to you, which cited a number of studies, all of them done overseas, mostly in third world countries. I think the total sample size was less than 3,000, but it concluded that ivermectin was a viable treatment. So is there some reason people should not believe this research?
So I'm a physician. I'm not a politician. I'm a scientist. I'm an academician. And I speak only from that point of view. What is ivermectin? Ivermectin is actually a medication that is used to treat parasitic infections. And really, there's only one study that has shown anything that was done in vitro, which means in a culture dish, where ivermectin was shown to have some antiviral effects against several specific single-stranded RNA viruses. Now, COVID is a single-stranded RNA virus, and it was effective in this in vitro study against the SARS-CoV-2 virus. What they found was that the ivermectin could inhibit the replication of SARS-CoV-2 in monkey kidney cell cultures. Now, the thing is that they had to have a very high concentration of ivermectin in order to do that. And if you were to translate that concentration into the amount that you would give to a human being, it would be highly toxic. And so it's not translatable from being in a cell culture to being in human use. I don't think we should minimize its importance because it is a very important drug in the world because we don't see parasitic infections much in the United States, but in other third world countries, they do, and it's problematic, and it's an important drug in those countries. And frankly, the Nobel Prize was given for the discovery of ivermectin in 2015, so it is an important drug. But when we talk about how widely it's been studied, it also hasn't been studied that widely, and it certainly hasn't been studied at all in high doses.
So is there any FDA-grade double-blind study of ivermectin as a treatment for COVID?
So if we look at a journal like Journal of the American Medical Association, and there was a study published in March of this year that looked at the effect of ivermectin on the time to resolution of symptoms in adults with mild COVID-19 infections. It was done as a randomized clinical trial in 476 patients. And what they found was that the duration of symptoms was not significantly different for patients who received a five-day course of ivermectin when they compared that with patients who received placebo. Basically, they had the same time to resolution. Mm-hmm. Essentially, they concluded that their findings didn't support the use of ivermectin for treatment of mild COVID-19. Look, we did the same thing with hydroxychloroquine. You don't hear anybody talking about hydroxychloroquine anymore. It came and went as a fad.
One more issue that's been raised by a couple of listeners, that the threat of COVID has been exaggerated, that the death count is deceptive because the vast majority of these deaths are in people who had pre-existing conditions, prominent among them, extreme obesity, and that this is as much a symptom of our obesity epidemic as it is due to COVID. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I take care of children primarily, and I mean, I'm seeing all kinds of children who don't necessarily have any comorbid problems who are very sick from the illness and who are ending up on ECMO, the most extreme form of life support. And they don't have comorbid illnesses. They're not obese. I mean, I've had infants, you know, who are less than a year of age end up on ECMO who don't have any other medical problems. I mean, 98% of the cases now that we're seeing in children are from the Delta variant. This is the same thing that's being reported out of Texas Children's, which is the largest children's hospital in the country. They're also reporting that same number. So clearly the Delta variant is different when it comes to children than the initial variants were, and kids are getting sick. And sure, people who have comorbid conditions are always at greater risk of any type of infection, not just COVID, but any type of bacterial pneumonia or any other sort of viral illness, including the flu. So it's very easy to sort of write it off and say, oh, this is a result of our obesity epidemic. But if two-thirds of the population is obese, then, you know, by body mass index criteria, then two-thirds of the population is at risk of getting the illness and having severe disease as a result. So I wouldn't write it off that quickly. Yes, people who have comorbid conditions are absolutely a greater risk, but otherwise healthy people are also at significant risk. And many of those people are having this condition, this long COVID. 13% of people who get an infection have long COVID.
Wow.
So those are not all people who have serious comorbid conditions.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here is CBS senior business analyst Joe Schlesinger. The next inflation report is tomorrow. Always fascinating reading. But your big concern is about these persistent shortages of items like cars.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's going to be tough to catch up. And if you think about why this is all happening, you know, we have shipping containers that are in the wrong places. It's very expensive. There's a lot of problems in the global shipping network. But obviously, if you're a big manufacturer of semiconductor chips and it's the spring of 2020, you say, where am I going to focus my limited capacity? I'm going to focus it on home electronics, gaming systems. That's what people are going to need. No one was thinking about cars. So we are playing catch up to the car market. There's not enough semiconductor chips necessary. And as a result, we are seeing the lowest level of inventory for cars that people have seen in ages. Before the pandemic, we'd had 3 million new cars for sale in the United States. Now we're under a million. And that is putting price pressure on both the new car market and the used car market. It's still going to be with us. It is still hard to find a car.
That's why the dealership wants my old car back, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. And it's also funny because, you know, I had this come up with my mom. Her car was coming off lease, and I looked at the lease contract, and don't you know that there is a pre-calculated price for to buy a car out of lease? Now, the people who like leasing, they don't like to buy cars, so they very rarely will exercise that one option. I said to my mother, let's buy the car. It's cheaper than any car you could buy right now. And let's just say you want to be really cute, you could buy the car and sell it yourself for more than that price probably.
Wouldn't this be the ideal time to start onshoring some of the chip business that we offshored years ago?
Yeah, it would be, but it's not like the snap of a finger. It's not like saying, oh, you know what? I think that I'm going to move this today. You know, this process actually started to some extent when we had trade conflicts during the Trump administration. Now, by the way, a lot of those tariffs are still in place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, there have been moves to have companies try to nearshore or onshore some of the production capabilities, but it's not as if you can just say, poof, that happens. And we have labor shortages here, and there are no labor shortages across the globe. There are really labor shortages that are persistent in the United States. And so I think that we have to be a little bit sensitive to the fact that it's not as easy to turn that whole network on.
Okay. Not to deliberately depress people on a Monday, but let's talk about the federal budget for just a moment.
Okay.
I'm glad you have an optimistic attitude toward that. I saw the Treasury report that was released last week, which says that the richest 5% evade, and that's the word they used, evade, not just avoid, evade $307 billion a year in taxes. And, of course, they're trying to support the hiring of more IRS auditors, which Biden is trying to do. So do you agree with the idea of hiring more IRS auditors?
Yeah, they've been gutted. I mean, absolutely. And I think we should. This is not like, oh, we're going to go audit people who are not cheating the system. It's like people who are just not paying their taxes. We should really get that money back.
I mean, these are people who generally don't get W-2s, right? I mean, if you get a W-2, it's reported to the government, so you're not going to be able to evade taxes.
Right, right, exactly right. And I do think that it's important that we have a really, honest to gosh, when you think about this, that, you know, if everyone's paying taxes, we should all want this. I think that there's this weird notion where you say, oh, you know, I don't want more auditors because they'll come audit me. It's probably not going to be the case. The the biggest leakage in the system is among those who are self-employed and small businesses that kind of shuck and jive the system. And you know what? It's not fair. So we'd like rich people to pay their taxes. We'd like companies to pay their taxes. And we want everyone to just pay their fair share. That's it. We're not going and creating new taxes. We just want people to pay what they owe.
Any progress in taxing Bitcoin investors?
Well, no. I mean, I would say this. We have a very big problem, actually, not just taxing the Bitcoin people, but regulating. And that, to me, the regulatory environment for Bitcoin really needs to come into focus. It hasn't yet. Gary Gensler, he's the head of the SEC, is trying to do so. But I just think it's going to be awfully hard to get this going. And I'm not encouraged right now, because I think that often what will happen is that these folks who are regulating it, they don't understand it. And that's not good.
And also, did you see that Ethan Allen had to change its ticker symbol, ETH, because people thought that it was actually
Ethereum.
Ethereum, this cryptocurrency.
It's insanity. And I will say that I have come around to sort of embrace the fact that crypto and the backbone of crypto is actually very interesting. But we do, you know, you can't have the Wild West. You do need regulation for this. And for people who fight regulation, I usually think, well, why are you fighting that so hard? Doesn't seem to me that, like, if you're fighting regulation of that kind of stuff, you probably have something to hide. And it's not unlike the previous conversation around taxes, which is, if you have nothing to hide, you shouldn't really worry. And I know it's not pleasant going through an audit, but it's not pleasant to feel like you have to be regulated as an industry, but there are plenty of industries that are regulated and they thrive. Let's just look at financial services in general.
CBS Senior Financial Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thanks, Jill.
Great to be with you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Could it be that our chaotic democracy is just not prepared for a pandemic, and that China's going to win the economic game because they are prepared for a pandemic? I've been reading a book called Shutdown, How COVID Shook the World's Economy, written by Adam Tooze, who teaches history at Columbia. And it's I found it pretty disturbing. I mean, I came away with the feeling that basically, China won this.
I think it's fair to say that China certainly comes out of this looking much better than the West. Yeah, how could it not? The mortality amongst the Chinese population from this is orders of magnitude lower than in the West. The disruption of regular life in China has been dramatically less than it has been in the West. Its economy has taken less of a hit. In every respect, its regime appears to have demonstrated a much better ability to control the situation.
Right. That's exactly what I gathered from the book. So I'd call that an unforced error. But the thing is, the reason they were able to do that is because their government is able to exercise a level of control which we would never dream of permitting in the United States. So is that the only way we could have won this, by basically becoming a police state? Or do you think it's possible for a democracy, in the framework of a democracy, to exercise the kind of discipline necessary to nip this kind of thing in the bud?
There are certain exceptions which are really worth studying. The most notable is somewhere like South Korea, because this, after all, was not really the toughest or most dangerous kind of pandemic that we could have faced at all. And if you were quick to the mark, if you realized early on how dangerous it was, you started envisioning various types of shutdown and you developed adequate testing, you could get a grip on this. Many countries did, much better than was the case ultimately, you know, on the east coast of the United States in the spring and now running all the way through to the summer of this year. And so there were indeed definitely things that could have been done better. It depended, I think, crucially on that combination of alertness, early willingness to contemplate the unthinkable, and then the technological capacity to test at an early stage when the outbreak was still relatively small. And so even early stage testing technologies were enough to track it. And that's turns out, I think, to have been the secret of South Korean success.
Yeah.
So I don't think we need to be profoundly gloomy about democracy in general, but do we need to up our game to continue the sporting metaphor? We absolutely do. I mean, we need to get serious about this. We need to realize that the dramatic warnings of epidemiologists are for real. This isn't just a horror movie. We're actually in it. And if we don't do this, we're going to have to do things which are, in their own way, much more damaging than what the Chinese regime had to ask its population to do. This is the funny thing about this, right? They actually end up asking a much smaller sacrifice of their population than we ended up inflicting on ourselves.
The problem is we have a tradition of rugged independence here in the U.S. where we don't take anybody's advice if we don't want to. And we're going to lose to China if we haven't already. I mean, their economy is, I believe, widely predicted to eclipse ours before long. And it sounds to me, based on what I read in your book, that the pandemic only hastened that.
That's maybe true. I wouldn't exaggerate this tradition of rugged individualism in the US as a fundamental obstacle to being sensible about things like public health. I mean, no doubt there is rugged individualism in the United States, but when the polio vaccine came along in the 60s, there were literally, people lining up around the block to get their kids vaccinated. There were parties in the street. People appreciated what this scientific breakthrough meant and how it was going to transform their lives. That's what we need to get back to. It's not a question of, as it were, rugged individualism per se. Those were just as much Americans as we are today, and indeed, many ways, much more rugged, because this was a society that was still...
Well, then what changed? How do you explain what's going on now?
I really think here we need to talk about cultural change and the culture wars. There has been a politicization of this issue of rugged individualism and an extension of that into skepticism towards things like medical science, which is profoundly dysfunctional. That is the problem. It still needs... be fatal. If we can get 60 to 70% of the most vulnerable bit of the population vaccinated quickly, the pandemic will run its course and we can actually handle it. So that recalcitrant minority of rugged individualists, even in its current, toxic politicized form, need not be a disaster. But that does put a premium on, doing the other stuff right, getting the testing in place quickly, really rolling that out. We need to be pouring resources into labs, into molecular biology, all that good stuff. This isn't money, in the same way as healthcare. I mean, those are great jobs. These are really valuable, worthwhile careers, well-paid. That's the future, really, of our economies is being more resilient in dealing with these kind of shocks. And we should welcome that. It's certainly something we should be willing to pay for, given the cost of the alternative.
You also bring up the social safety net, which you say is sorely lacking here. We still have people, even in the best of times, living paycheck to paycheck. So when something like this happens, they become desperate.
Absolutely. I mean, worse than that. I mean, we have tens of millions of people who report shortages of food in the United States, even in the good times. I mean, it should be an indictment of a society as wealthy as ours. And what America doesn't have is an effective, comprehensive, resilient unemployment insurance system. I mean, tens of millions of people were on the edge of just outright destitution, eviction from their homes, not having enough money to put food on the table. We all saw the extraordinary aerial footage of those queues of people in, middle-class cars queuing up for food.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a crisis of a type I never expected to see and really does awaken memories of the 1930s.
And so this was a huge stress test of the American system. You think we've learned from it? And is it fair to say that our position as the world's leading economy is at stake here?
Managing these kind of crises is going to be the test, yes. I think when we think about superpower competition, you can go down the conventional military route, but in a sense, I think that's the easy option, if I may say so, the sort of, counting up your nuclear weapons and deciding who's got most and who can do second strikes and so on. That's the game we know how to play and how to win, and I don't think that is going to be the game. Certainly, if we're talking about the actual security of people, what makes them safe, it's going to be how we deal with hurricanes and massive flooding events, the sort of thing that have shocked America this summer, or pandemics like this. That's what actually makes people safe and enables them to carry on their way of life as they expect. And I don't think that the 2020 experience makes one confident that America is well prepared for those kind of challenges.
Yeah. Adam Tooze teaches at Columbia. He's the author of Shutdown, How COVID
Shook the World's Economy, a deeply researched book with all sorts of footnotes, but also quite shocking in looking at this pandemic in a new way, in the effect it has had on the way we define national security, and of course, what could be a coming conflict with China. Adam, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness is sponsored by Robert W. Baird. When America was attacked on 9/11, 38 jetliners headed for the U.S. were diverted to a small town of Gander, Newfoundland. Locals called their sudden guests the Plain People, and in years since, the hospitality has never been forgotten, even immortalized in Broadway plays, books, and now this report from CBS News.
They would come to the Lions Club and say, hey, who needs a shower? Come over to my place.
You've seen people coming up to passengers, locals, and giving them that hug. Don't you worry about a thing. We got you.
Oz Fudge was the town constable in Gander on 9/11. And one of the first people I met.
If you look at the world today and you look at what's happening and you see on the TV and you see on your Facebook and everything, how people are getting angry at each other and they're fighting on airplanes and they're fighting on trains and they're fighting in grocery stores. And now people are looking at this play and reading the books and seeing the documentaries and going, I remember. That's what it was like when I was growing up, and they're longing for that.
For Roxanne, 9/11 was an especially scary time. She was bringing home Alexandra, a 2-year-old infant she adopted in Kazakhstan. Now 22, Alexandra is well aware of what happened on that fateful day.
I've tried to instill in all of my kids to continue with that kindness. You know, anytime they see anyone that needs any help, we don't know their story. We don't know what they're going through. We just know they need help. So help them.
And I actually cut this story down a lot for time. But what they talk about, too, is just the difference between getting through trauma then and everybody coming together and helping each other. And we're all in this and hugs and strangers. And now the trauma of the pandemic, which seems to be tearing people apart. People are arguing in airplanes and in grocery stores and so I think what everybody was trying to extract from the 20-year mark of 9/11 this year is how different we're reacting to this trauma. And everybody's calling for, remember when Americans came together and helped each other get out of trauma and tragedy? So, you know, these stories are important to hear that it's possible for us to come together.
Yeah. Of course, back then, everybody figured this is an external enemy. And now
yes,
it's the internal enemy.
There is that big difference, yeah. Who is the enemy? The enemy this time is the virus, not each other.
From the G and Ursula Show, which you can hear weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott. I didn't get a chance to squeeze a prediction out of you for the game, so did you predict it was going to be the romp that it was?
No.
And what was different? What did you miss by not predicting that?
There's a new offensive coordinator that the Seahawks have, Shane Waldron. He was a part of the Rams organization. He was there with Sean McVay. He was LeStute. And, of course, Sean McVay, head coach for the Rams, is the teacher. Now, just because you're the student don't mean that you learn everything. Trust me, ask myself. I have had plenty of teachers that don't mean I learned. In this case, watching the Seahawks offense felt different this time. And here's what stood out to me. Sure, the Seahawks they've been pretty good over the last 10 years when it comes to offense. But usually the offense is guided by incredible things happening. Let me take you to the beginning. Marshawn Lynch. Mm-hmm. He made incredible things happen. Russell Wilson. He made incredible things happen. Then, as of late, we've seen DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett. The offense was kind of like just on incredible things happening. The difference yesterday, and I want to get a little nerdy and technical, but I'm just going to simplify it. It was the scheme. It was the offensive plan. Basically saying, yes, we have individuals, but the offense is not going to be guided by individuals. The offense is going to be guided by a proper plan and a proper system and scheme in place. What I saw yesterday against the Colts was a very well executed plan. And I'm like, okay, Seahawks, I love what I'm seeing. So that is what I saw yesterday. I didn't expect that, right? I did not expect for them to look that good. I'm glad they do, because I'm glad they do, because they play in the NFC West in a division that is the toughest division in football. The Arizona Cardinals, they look great. The Rams yesterday against the, last night against the Bears, they look great. And I know this sounds funny and I shouldn't be saying this, but the Niners don't look that bad either.
Uh-oh. So
it is going to be a very tough division. But like, I just want to say what I saw from the Seahawks yesterday, it was really good. I'm super duper excited about the home opener this weekend at Lumen Field.
And who are they playing this weekend? Because it wasn't just the Colts. Because I remember asking you.
Is it the Titans?
I remember asking you last week, is it that the Colts are bad? Are we just going to stomp them? So it's not that the Colts were bad. It's that the Seahawks were organized and good.
The Colts are good, right? Let me just say this. Every NFL team is good, especially when there's an away team, right? Like the Colts, it was a home opener for them, right? It was the first time that the stadium is packed, right? And then the Seahawks, a 10 o'clock game. We all know, remember in the past, back in the day, when the Seahawks would have 10 o'clock games, like, oh my goodness, Seahawks are strong. Man, they have been rocking on the road. They've been doing very well, this whole new system that Pete Carroll has with them traveling and everything. He's got that dialed in. So, look, I got to tell you, I did not expect, and even if they did win, right? Even if the Seahawks did win, it probably would have been like, oh my goodness, can you believe it? I was on the edge of my seat. I was biting my nails. You know how the Seahawks do us. Yep. Y'all know how they make our blood pressure go up.
So I know this was that the first part of the game, they established that Russell to Lockett connection, right? And that was cooking.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they premiere the Russell to Metcalf connection. And that's what I thought was genius. You set up one thing, and then you hit him upside the head with something else.
Yeah. Here's another thing, too. Now, number three, Russell Wilson. He's been a pretty good quarterback for the Seahawks this entire career. No doubt about that. I mean, we don't need to go through the numbers, and we know what he has done since he's been here. But there's a new Russell Wilson right now, and I want to explain that by just letting you know that dude trained with Tim Grover over the offseason. Tim Grover was the trainer for Michael Jordan and the trainer for Kobe Bryant. And that's who has been giving the tutelage and the lessons and everything, the hard, vigorous training. Russell looks good. He's trimmed down. He looks like if he's not playing football, he's going to be in an action movie. So
is that ideal for a quarterback to be slim and trim?
No, yes, that's ideal. Yeah, that doesn't usually happen. I mean, don't get me wrong. Look, no disrespect to the quarterbacks. But, you know, they ain't really got to really be that physically. Like, give me another quarterback in the NFL. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I'm thinking about Tom Brady. He's like a string bean.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, Tom Brady looks hungry.
Yeah, Russell Wilson got fed.
Tom Brady, you're good, but you're hungry. Like, you're giving that press conference, you're holding that trophy, and your stomach's growling. Right now, Russell Wilson looks fantastic. And by the way, if there's a book out there, I'm just giving you guys some advice. It's called Winning. Over the weekend, I read this book, Winning, by Tim Grover. Michael Jordan was his first client that he ever had. He had never trained anyone until Michael Jordan years ago. So he was learning on the fly. So imagine your first client being Michael Jordan. Oh, yeah, maybe you've learned some stuff over the way. Then, of course, Kobe Bryant. And now this is who has been training Russell Wilson. And I just think, man, Russell Wilson looks kind of different out there this year. He looks very good. And that's saying a lot considering what he's done in the past.
G. Scott joins Ursula, 9 o'clock on Kai Radio. Thanks, G.
See you guys.
And here it is, September 13th, which means the governor's latest mask mandate is now officially in effect, and the clock is ticking for school staff in Washington to turn in their proof of vaccination. Let's go live to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave, and welcome back.
Thank you.
So we have most of the kids in the state are now back in school, and Governor Inslee says if we want it to stay that way, we have got to stop the spread of the Delta variant.
Using our masks and more people getting vaccines, a safe, effective, free vaccine. We know masking is one of the things we can do. It's very important to protect all of us, but particularly those who cannot protect themselves. Those are kids under the age of 12 who cannot get the vaccine. That includes people who are immunocompromised in some sense. A mask helps everyone, but when we wear it, it particularly helps those innocent children who cannot protect themselves with a vaccine under 12. It allows us, hopefully, to continue to allow them to be in school, and it protects our loved ones who can't take the vaccine because they're immunocompromised in some sense.
Now, so starting today, not only do you have to wear your mask indoors,
we will expand our current facial covering requirement to include large outdoor events of over 500 people. It's very similar to the measures recently adopted by King and Pierce County. Again, this is an expansion of our existing order for everyone age 5 and up to wear masks in all indoor public settings as well, regardless of vaccination status. So this adds to that essentially existing requirement.
Now, the governor blaming super spreader events for this new mandate.
At the Watershed Festival at the Gorge led to more than 200 infections from that one event, and it was outdoors. The outdoors remain the safest place for people to be. We understand that. But when people are packed tightly together, we're getting transmission and ultimate hospitalizations and death. When you combine large crowds with the Delta variant, without any mitigation measures in place, we're going to keep seeing these super spreader events, even in outdoor environments. Science has proven that masks can reduce the risk of those transmissions.
Now, while many people Cairo 7 TV spoke with are on board with this order,
I believe that it will make it safer for me to go places, and it makes it safer for other people too.
This virus is spreading like wildfire, and anything that we can do to stop it is fine with me.
Others, not so much.
The vaccine, according to what I read this morning, is adequate to beat the Delta variant. Where is the science in this order? As far as I'm concerned, he's a science denier, despite the fact he thinks he is following the science, because he isn't.
Now, Dr. Nathan Slicker is with he is the head of the State Medical Association, and he says it is vital that we do everything we can as we head into winter.
A couple of things that I think really portend a challenging winter for us. One, that IMHE's model and other data really suggests that even when we're done with this peak, hopefully in the next month, we don't settle back down to the base where we were previously. We don't get back to, you know, the roughly 3% of the hospital being full with COVID. If you look at IMHE's data, it really argues that, you know, we'll be holding on to 10 to 12% of our beds with COVID patients in it, potentially for the winter. That is, we don't have 10 to 12% extra capacity in the health system, either in space or in people.
Now, on top of that,
so COVID's the first headwind there. The second major headwind is the flu. We, you know that the flu comes around every year. We didn't have one last year because people didn't gather and we didn't mask, or people masked. If we this year don't mask and we gather, we're going to be back to a regular flu season.
And for those who argue that nobody's really dying from this,
it's good that the death rate isn't soaring and that people aren't dying. But the amount of people that are getting incredibly sick and maybe on oxygen for the rest of their life or have limitations on what they can do to make themselves happy is enormous. And that's the thing is people aren't dying. They're just going to live with a chronic debilitating disease potentially now.
And the one thing he really wants everyone to keep in mind.
The reality is it's not just COVID that's getting impacted anymore. It is impacting everyone who touches the healthcare system. It's impacting our ability to get blood, to get people to provide care, to be able to have space to care for you. So don't just say, I won't die from COVID, it's no biggie. You're going to die potentially because you get in a car accident on I-5 and there's nowhere to provide care to you. There's no space for you. There's no blood supply to take care of you when you've got that critical internal bleeding because you have busted your spleen in your car accident. So please don't think that it's only about COVID. It's about every other disease that is getting impacted.
Now, there is a little bit of good news. The IHME latest modeling that came out on Friday does suggest that several states are entering this peak, and that includes Washington State. However, it's a very, very slow-moving peak. It's more of a plateau. And basically what IHME is saying at this point is that regardless of what we do, they expect for COVID-19 transmission and the burden to the healthcare system to likely extend well past their forecast period, which is the end of the year, and well into 2022 and beyond. Now, on top of that, the school vaccinations that are going to be required, that's October 8th, that all of the school staff have to have those. Already seeing reports of in Chehalis and Centralia, only 30% of the school staff have so far proven, turned in their proof of vaccination. So some low levels there.
Okay, so for Sunday's Seahawks game, you'd have to wear a mask then.
Yes, but I believe the Seahawks had done that on their own, if I'm not mistaken,
prior to.
But yeah,
because I know they were requiring proof of vaccination. But under this mandate, even if you are fully vaccinated, and you're in a big crowd outdoors, you still are supposed to wear a mask.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I had just been that had been in effect. Actually, King County had already done that and Pierce County had already done that. And now that this is a statewide thing that the governor has expanded it to. And it's a good idea. I was at the Green Day concert a week ago today. And there that was the last one in King County you could go to and not be masked. And at least half, if not much more, of the people there were not masked up.
Yeah. Now, I was shopping in Snohomish County yesterday. I didn't notice anybody masked up in the stores. Do you have to mask up in the stores, too, now?
You are supposed to be masked up, and there's an indoor mask mandate. You bet. There's. Yeah. Everyone is. That is a state-level indoor mask
mandate. So counties can't opt out of that one?
No, they cannot. And I believe several of the counties have done that on their own as well. I too, have seen folks in Snohomish County who don't do that. It's there's a little less buy-in in Snohomish County, I think, than in, say, King County.
Yeah.
But for the most part, every place I've been, I've seen people masking up inside.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.